Thanks. Yeah, so you're going to get an hour, at least an hour's worth of GD1. So afterwards, there'll be a vote for us to rename the stream. As Wynn was saying, GD1 is rather dull, so we can probably come up with something better. There we go. So I thought I'd give a more recent photo for Catherine to include in her talk. So this is mostly work that I did as a toddler that I'm going to be showing you. And also, I changed my subtitle here for Christoph. So weather happens in the Halo too, and I'll show you some examples of that. So we've already seen this map that Anna made. It's a reproduction of Vasily's Field of Streams using SCSS data. So people have already mentioned that there's abundant substructure in the form of stellar streams and shells and clouds and things like that out in the Halo. And so this is interesting and exciting because we think we understand essentially how these structures form, and so we can use them to understand properties of the Milky Way at large. So this is the, as I said, the SCSS view. Now, of course, we know of many other streams, thanks to Carl Grillmeyer and Nora, and more recently from Kiati, Malhan, and Rodrigo with their Stream Finder. So depending on your sort of degree of believability, we now know of between 30 and 60 or so streams, maybe more. What?
More than that.
Ah, okay, Ting says more. All right, fine. In any case, they all have sort of similar large-scale characteristics. So metal pour, as we expect from systems that accrete onto the Milky Way and disrupt. Very large aspect ratios, so much smaller widths than their lengths. And most of these systems are found in the stellar halo, sort of away from the galactic disk, although that's sort of changing now that Rodrigo and his group are using proper motions and other things where they can go to regions with higher contamination. But in any case, most of these streams are found where dark matter dominates the force field, and so the goal is to then use these streams to try to understand something about the formation of the Milky Way and of the nature of dark matter. And the reason I think they're so exciting is because, at least to first order, we think we understand how streams form. So if you have a fluffy stellar body orbiting around a larger mass like the Milky Way, then we think that these systems will disrupt through just tidal stripping, ordinary tidal stripping, which, as Catherine mentioned, happens on a sort of energy scale that scales with the satellite mass over the enclosed mass of the Milky Way to this 1/3 power. And so that tells us that if you plug in numbers for typical systems around the Milky Way, the typical energy scales of the streams, of the different orbits of the stars in these streams, is very, very small, fractionally. And so that means that because the stars in these streams have small spreads in energy, the stars almost trace out an orbit, not exactly. Once we have orbit information, this gives us information about acceleration field, and from the acceleration field, we can then learn about the sort of global distribution of dark matter. And there's a long history of work on this from many people in the room. Another reason streams are exciting is because it was realized fairly early on that they're sensitive to both the global structure of dark matter and mass, but they're also sensitive to small-scale structure. That's because they're such cold dynamical structures. So if you have a subhalo or some perturber pass by or pass through a stream, it leaves an imprint. So it can create gaps, as Ray showed here, or create spur features or underdensities and overdensities along streams. And this has also been a field that's been studied quite a bit in simulations. So the presence or the lack of substructure around the Milky Way should imprint itself on the streams that we observe. So why care about streams? They encode all of this interesting information, global dark matter distribution, small-scale dark matter distribution, and they are sort of the fossil record of things that accreted onto the Milky Way. So here I just want to show you some complexities that we've looked at over the past couple of years that may make our sort of cartoon picture of stream formation a little bit harder to interpret. And some of the observed consequences of these effects. And then most of the talk I'm going to spend focusing on one particular stream, and with Anna, we hope to convince you that this is a stream that demands a lot of our attention. And so I'm going to spend most of my time talking about what we do and don't know and should know about this GD1 stream. And then Anna will talk about using the features of this stream to constrain physics, to constrain dark matter or perturber models of things that could interact with the stream. Okay, so The first point I just want to briefly go through is that streams around the Milky Way are fairly complex. They're not the thin linear structures that we all still call them. And to illustrate some of the processes that can affect streams, that can make them non-linear or diffuse or more complex, I want to show you a couple simulations. So here is a stream formed in a spherical NFW-only dark matter distribution. So the stream, you know, forms this nice, thin, cold structure. It's on a regular orbit, so nothing funny is happening. But different processes can affect the observed morphology of streams. So as Catherine mentioned, you can have chaos or the new term that I hadn't even heard, separatrix diffusion or divergence. Yeah, there you go. If you have a bar or more complexity to the gravitational potential, you can end up with large-scale perturbations to the density structure of streams. And if you have a small-scale subhalo pass through the stream, can't really see it here, but if you zoom in, you know, you can leave under-densities along the physical morphology or the distribution of stars in the stream. And the reason that I'm mentioning these particular effects, I'm sure there's many, many others, and Ray had a recent paper showing one of the more exotic things that can happen if you have a ringing halo. The reason I'm mentioning these few is that we think we see streams around the Milky Way that have imprints of these different effects. So I just want to very quickly flash a couple of things before focusing in on GD1. So the first is PAL5, which is sort of typically mentioned as the canonical example of a thin, nice, simple stream, because so here's PAL5, the cluster, here's the trailing tail and the leading tail. Oops. But one of the peculiarities of PAL5 is that if you use much deeper photometric data and try to filter and pull out the two tails, you find that they're quite asymmetric, which is very different from what you'd expect from, for example, the simulations that Sarah has done, or Andreas Cooper, or Walter Danin, where you run an n-body simulation of a Palomar 5-like globular cluster disrupting. You expect to find much more symmetric tails that don't have these interesting wiggles and kinks in them. So one example of something that could be at play here, so here's an example, a stream model in just an axisymmetric static Milky Way model where you see this sort of nice symmetric leading and trailing tail. One thing that could be at play here is the fact that the pericenter of Palomar 5 is between 7 and 8 kiloparsecs or so. And so that puts it within the sort of region of influence of the galactic bar. So if the bar is as massive as Ortwin tells us, and so here's a particular model in which I put in a bar with a pattern, or Sarah put in a bar with a pattern speed of 38 kilometers per second per kiloparsec, or translated for James here. This is what the observed morphology of the stream looks like if you evolve it for a long time. So you can end up with asymmetries and density perturbations to the stream. I'm not saying this is the model for PAL5, I'm just saying that this clearly demonstrates that a massive bar with this kind of pattern speed can leave an imprint on a stream like Palomar 5. Another stream that is probably in a similar situation, probably even more extreme, is the Ophiuchus stream. So this one, you have to really put on your astronomer goggles for. It's just this 2-degree long thing right here, possibly a little extension. That's it. That's the stream called Ophiuchus. There's a very steep distance gradient, so part of the reason it's so short is that we're seeing it foreshortened on the sky. But it does appear to be fairly short and has a fairly low stellar mass. So the distance from the sun is about 9 kiloparsecs, but it's directly above, so it's comparable to GD1, but it's directly above the bulge rather than the opposite direction. So if you look at the orbit of, say, BHB stars that are associated with the stream, these are the same BHB stars. Here's a XZ plane look at the Milky Way. This is what its orbit is doing. So its pericenter is very, very close to the bar, sort of within the bar itself. So we expect the direct time-dependent torques and influence of the bar to imprint itself on the morphology of the debris that comes off for this particular stream. Another stream that I'm just going to flash by, because I think Ting might mention it later, that again, these are sort of all streams that were found in SDSS or PanSTARRS, and so we thought they were relatively simple and linear straight features from looking at their photometric maps, but now have all these other extra complexities. Another stream is this orphan stream, shown here in R. Lyrae stars. This is from a paper that Sergey and Vasily led. Half the people in this room are on this paper, so if you haven't heard about it, just ask your neighbor. But the point is that, so Sergey and Vasily noticed that you can actually trace Orphan another 100 degrees or so, 80 degrees into the southern hemisphere. And so the total extent of the stream now is quite long. It's about 100 kiloparsecs or so. And if you look at the R. Lyrae now in a rotated coordinate system, so that we're trying to put the stream sort of along latitude equals zero, and you then bin the proper motions of the stars in the stream and just plot them on this plot, as Nora mentioned, you might naively expect these arrows, if you correct for solar motion, to point along the stream. And instead, for Orphan, you see this interesting deviation over here, where they sort of bend away and then bend back. And this also happens to be, actually, it's a little bit over here, it is the closest point to the LMC. So it seems like Orphan is actually feeling the time-dependent influence of the LMC. I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember if...
From the spectroscopy thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, the point of all this is just to say a lot of streams are affected by complex processes, and so, you know, weather happens in the halo too. Most of these effects are interesting to study in their own right. I'm not going to talk about those. Instead, I want to focus on a much narrower question, which is, for what streams can we ignore many of these effects to disentangle all of these complexities and actually try to study properties of dark matter? And so the one point I want you to take away is that GD1, I think, is the most promising from this perspective. But there's still a lot of mess. So GD1 of 1, so that's, I think, one of the reasons we're thinking we should rename it, was discovered by Carl Grohmeyer and Dionatos. That's where the GD comes from. So this is what it looked like in the discovery paper in 2006. So it's the longest thin stream we know of. So I'm calling it a thin stream and not a globular cluster stream, which we now know to be about 100 degrees in length from our perspective, or about 13 to 15 kiloparsecs in length. It's fairly metal poor, so metallicity of -2 or so, maybe even lower. And it has a fairly old stellar population. And for a stream, it's nice because it's relatively nearby. It has a distance only of 8 to 10 kiloparsecs or so. So already in this discovery paper, you can sort of see hints of density variations from just doing matched filtering on photometric data. And Ray has spent quite a bit of time trying to model and look at the density variations from this initial work from Carl. Then came Sergei Kapasov, who essentially took the same SDSS data, I think it was maybe a little bit later on, and reanalyzed the stream. So this is now looking in, again, a coordinate system where we're trying to put the stream along a great circle. So it's a rotated heliocentric coordinate system. So phi1 is kind of like a stream longitude, and phi2 is a stream latitude. Again, you have to squint, but that's GD1 right there. So the aspect ratio here is kind of crazy. This is like 90 degrees versus 8 degrees or so. So what Sergey did was use binned measurements of the track along the sky, proper motions, which actually hold pretty well in the Gaia era, distance information and radial velocities. He used that information to fit an orbit and measure, in a very simple galactic model, the circular velocity at the location of GD1 and the flattening of the potential. So we found a circular velocity around 220 kilometers per second and very mildly axisymmetric halo. Already here, you again see some of the evidence of that density variation along the stream. So there's regions like this that appear much denser than, for example, right here. And so even if you look back to 2010 at a statement that Sergey made, it's interesting, blah, blah, blah. Clumpiness in the observed stream may be attributed to these past interactions. So it looks like Sergey is still working on this. So in the meantime, we decided to see what we could do with GD1 by looking at the Gaia data. And so that's what I wanted to show you here. So just to orient you on the sky, this is sort of the footprint of where we think GD1 is, most of GD1, the GD1 stream is in ICRS, so just standard equatorial RA in DEC. Here it is in galactic coordinates. So notice that on one end here, the color coding is going to appear in, again. On one end here, on this red end, it gets very close to the galactic disk. But note that most of the stream is at high galactic latitude, and we're at the anti-center. So already, that's good, because it means the background, stellar background, is going to be fairly low. So here's that same footprint, but now in this GD1 coordinate system, where I've tried to stretch the, or make the aspect ratio closer to 1 here. So this is that stream longitude, stream latitude. So this is the area that gets closer to the disk. If you actually, if you filter this, you actually see the structures that Shervin was mentioning, some of the feathers in the outer disk that cross through the footprint here. Click. Okay, so this is, the density here is just showing all Gaia cross-matched to pan-stars in this part of the sky. So notice it looks pretty spatially uniform. There's not a lot of evidence of selection function or other issues. But if you make a very simple cut, not even a cut on parallax quality, you just say, I want things that are very distant, that don't have confidently measured parallaxes in Gaia, even just making this parallax cut, all of a sudden you start to see these sort of bands, these striping features that arise because of the Gaia scan pattern, the Gaia selection function. So those are regions that are more incomplete. So right away, I'll come back to this, but right away note that just doing this cut on astrometry induces some density variations in this space. Just to emphasize how easy it is to find GD1, I want to show you a very simple experiment here. So this is the color magnitude diagram G minus I versus G in this entire footprint here in this part of the sky. The red line here is just an isochrone shifted to the distance of GD1 that Sergey told us. So this is a metal pore minus 1.8, I think. 12 gigayear isochrone. This is the proper motion distribution. Now in proper motions rotated into this coordinate system that's roughly aligned with the stream. So if I do something very simple and just select a box close to the turnoff, you already on the right here see GD1. It's this little feature that pokes out from, this is the disk and the regular halo over here. So GD1, that tells us right away, just doing a very, very simple cut in color magnitude diagram, GD1 is kinematically distinct from the disk and from the halo. So that makes it a very good stream when, if we could do something this stupid and see evidence for the stream in proper motion space, that means by doing some more sophisticated things that I'll show you, we'll get a very high contrast view of the stream, which we need to be able to study density variations along the stream, thereby study dark matter. So if we then do another very simple cut proper in color magnitude diagram and in proper motions, and just plot the sky positions of the stars that appear in that region, there it is. It's, you know, like fish in a barrel. So, of course, we can do something a little bit better than that, and that's what we did very soon after Gaia DR2, Anna and I. So this is doing a slightly more sophisticated but still pretty rigid selection of stars using the proper motions and the photometry, and plotting the distribution on the sky of all or in this GD1 coordinate system of all of those mostly main sequence turnoff stars. And so this revealed a couple things. So one, the stream extends. You can actually peer closer to the disk, because with photometry alone, you get a lot of foreground contamination. You can't track the stream as far. So we revealed this sort of previously undetected part of the stream over here, revealed that these density variations that were hinted at from the SCSS data are actually quite significant. But we also see a couple of other features that are sort of tantalizing in their relation to the previous figures I showed you from simulations of subhalos or substructures interacting with streams. So in particular, there's this spur feature over here, and then there's a more diffuse overdensity that we call the blob over here. So this is doing a fairly simple selection. You can obviously do a lot better by realizing that there's a distance gradient over the stream, and so the color magnitude diagram changes as a function of where you are in longitude along the stream. So if we fit for the distance trend along the stream, you can select more efficiently the stars at any given location. And you can do the same thing in proper motion space. So this is, again, showing proper motion along longitude versus proper motion in latitude. And the proper motion of the stream changes depending on where you look along the stream. So the next order thing you can do is just build a model that selects stars that follows the mean proper motion and the mean distance of the stream in these two plots. So if you do that, and then it sounds like doing something similar to what Nora is doing, where we, at any given longitude, we're simultaneously modeling the variation of the background, so what the disk and the halo is doing, and what the mean and distribution of proper motions of the stream is, using Gaussian mixture models. This allows us to handle the covariant, non-trivial astrometric errors that Gaia provides us, and also figure out what the track of the stream is in proper motion space. Yeah?
Can I ask the Gaussian mixture in what space?
Sorry, this is in proper motion space. Yeah. Yeah.
But you do have a parallax cut.
There's a parallax cut, yeah. So this was the initial selection we did. If you instead build this model and cut on essentially probability instead, you get a much cleaner view. So just to blink back and forth here. So this is sort of what we've been doing lately, is simultaneously inferring the distance, proper motion versus longitude with a background model as well. So again, the spur didn't go away and the blob still looks like it's there. So this is now just showing sort of a zoom in, bins in phi 2 at different longitudes along the stream. So this is taking little bins in phi 1 here and looking at what the collapse distribution in the phi 2 direction is. And so this spur feature, just in case you don't think that it's real, that's this extra little blob or hump that comes out over here and then decays away as you go to larger longitude. So
is it moving to the right? I forget what.
Oh, it's moving actually to negative. Yeah. Did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. The stream we didn't change the coordinate system. That was probably a mistake. But I think that we should have some uniform decision that we define our stream coordinate system so that they always go in positive longitude. But we just used what Sergey had done. Say what? Well, he had proper motions. Sergey defined the coordinate system and he had proper motions. But we'll take it up with Sergey.
We have a long history of changing the coordinate systems upside down and backwards every paper.
There you go. So we tried to be consistent with previous work here. Okay, so now that we have a sort of a better way of selecting stars, where we now have probabilities for individual stars, we're not just doing this rigid fixed cut, we can now look at some more detailed properties of the stream. So in particular, we can start to quantify the density variations. We can characterize its stellar population and look for other tracers that might be along the stream that can help us try to understand its history, its formation, what the progenitor was. And we can also attempt to fit model streams to the data. How much time do I have, by the way?
More than five?
7 minutes. Good. Okay, so just a big caveat, this is all, basically from here on, this is all things I did over the last 2-3 weeks, so this is all very fresh, and I don't have grand conclusions, I have a lot of questions, hopefully, for all of you. So the first thing, just to show you briefly here, we want to measure essentially which of these gaps in underdensities is real, how deep they are, and which ones are due to essentially the Gaia selection function or scan pattern. So the first thing I had to do in order to start quantifying this is build a selection function for Gaia in this part of the sky. And so this is what I got. I won't go through the details of that. It wasn't very hard for this very particular situation, but this is the probability of a star getting an astrometric solution, or the fraction of stars in a given region of the sky that get an astrometric solution from Gaia, ratioed to the total number of stars in that bin at the magnitude cut that we're using. So you can see there's pretty large variations here from essentially all stars over here getting an astrometric solution to these stripy regions where it's only sort of 40 to 50%. So clearly in these regions, we need to include this selection function in order to model the true density there. So here, just to blink where the stream is there. So a lot of the small-scale variations over here are likely due to the scan pattern or the selection function of Gaia. But notice that this spur feature doesn't appear to be affected by the selection function. So if you do that, if you include the selection function and you take the high probability members of GD1 and you include a background model and you infer what the density structure of the stream is, I'm just showing you here the sort of best fitting value. In principle, we should be sampling over all these parameters, but I made this plot last night and I didn't have time to run MCMC. Here's the inferred background model that we have. So this is the true model density of the stream. This is a zoom in of that. And so the takeaway here is that, like Thomas and Vasily and many others found from deeper imaging of this region, there's quite significant wiggles and width variations and still very significant gaps in the stream. And so we have to, try to understand all of them, but also try to quantify the sort of density contrast between any individual gap in the neighboring part of the stream in order to ask which ones are consistent with impacts or perturbations and which ones could just be more boring explanations, I guess. So good. Another thing we can look at is the stellar population. So here's, again, the high probability members of GD1. And now I'm going to just select stars that are in this band around the stream and then use these two control fields here to look at what the background looks like in this part of the sky. So one thing we can do is just construct a stream-wide luminosity function of stars. So that's what I'm showing in the black line here. The red line is a Krupa mass function involved with an isochrone, old metal poor isochrone. So the first time I made this, I looked at that deficit there and thought, mass segregation? You know, there's a deficit of low mass stars. Maybe they're further out beyond the edge of the stream. By the way, the total mass you get from doing this is about 4 by 10 to the 4 solar masses. But it turns out you pretty much only see the deficit in low mass. This is now looking at the luminosity function along the stream, so in individual fields. You only see this deficit in mainly these fields, which is exactly where the selection function comes in. So you're seeing it at the faintest magnitudes where the selection function hurts you the most. Here's another thing. So rather than looking at the total luminosity function, we can look at the distribution of stars in color magnitude space. So this is now shifting any individual field by the distance that we know that field is at from doing the distance modeling along the stream and stacking all of the CMDs. So you very clearly see the stream pop out right here. This is doing the same thing for those control fields and then differencing them. So when I made this, right away what pops out is this clump of stars over here, which are blue horizontal branch stars. So these are two isochrones showing an old, very metal poor, and a slightly younger metal poor isochrone. So things to note here are there's clearly BHB and red horizontal branch or RLIRA stars along with blue stragglers associated with the stream. So one thought that came to mind was to look at this ratio of the number of blue stragglers to the number of horizontal branch stars that we see in the stream, because that actually correlates with the total luminosity of the system. So this is a plot from, Momani, showing in absolute magnitude this log of this ratio. So globular clusters live in sort of this region of the space. They tend to have actually fewer blue straggler stars than horizontal branch stars. Dwarf galaxies have a sequence up here, and so my first thought was maybe we can actually learn about whether GD1 was a globular cluster or a dwarf from showing where it is in this plot. Fortunately, it's right there. So, you know, it could be either, I would say. It's still uncertain. Here's where those stars are along the stream. So this is just selecting in a footprint around the stream the essentially these stars right here. Now looking at their distance moduli, so you see there's something of a distance gradient along the stream. Some of them are blue enough that BOSS accidentally targeted them as quasars, and so some of them actually have radial velocities. And so all I did was take the stars in the footprint that have a radial velocity, plotting radial velocity versus phi 1, and you see this very clear sequence that's consistent with what Sergey found. Anyway, so this is all just, you know, here's what I found, but GD1 seems to have a total stellar mass comparable to a low-mass globular cluster or an ultra-faint, so I'd say we still don't really know the nature of the progenitor. There's no clear evidence for luminosity function variations along the stream, but the turnoff that we see is actually just a very small range of masses, of stellar masses. So it could be that the mass segregation effects are much deeper in the CMD. Another thing is GD1, we now know, has many blue stragglers and a few horizontal branch stars, so this will help us to to model the stream, but using this to try to get at the nature of the progenitor is sort of inconclusive so far. So let me jump forward to the questions I have for you. If I can find my cursor. We tried doing, the only other thing that I'm skipping here is we tried doing some, actually, why don't I just click through it. We tried doing some stream fitting, but clearly this is the best fitting stream model we get, and it clearly sucks, so there's work to do there. But we did actually recover the same values that Sergey got. So even with the longer stream, the better data, we're still catching up to Sergey from 2010. And there's a lot of details of the fitting that we did that still are totally wrong. No, so this is just fitting a logarithmic, only logarithmic halo with a flattening.
We have time for questions.
Yeah. I have one plot for Win here. So this is the orbit that we get for GD1 from doing the stream fitting. So notice this is the direction that the sun is moving, and this is the direction that the stream is going, so it's retrograde. So if you look at energy and LZ, this is apogee stars, metal poor apogee stars. I think this is the sausage, and maybe this is your sequoia. And GD1 is right over here, so I don't know. So we know what we know about GD1. Because of its properties, its intrinsic properties, it's a great stream to look at if you want to study density variations. And that's because it's retrograde with respect to other stellar populations. It's mostly at high galactic latitude. It's close. It has a pericenter far enough from the bar that we don't think that impacts it. We think the potential is close to spherical or axisymmetric in the region that it occupies. And it's well populated, so it's dense and long. So given all of this, it should be very useful for studying small-scale dark matter, and that's what Anna's going to talk about. And here's my questions for you. So I'll end here and let you read the questions and give me answers.
Thank you, Adrian. Question?
So I'm not answering any of these. So Webb and Bovey had a paper arguing basically based on the length of the stream that we see that one of the gaps should be from the progenitor. And I saw now in BHB stars, it looks like you're actually maybe mapping the stream to be even longer at positive phi ones. So I was going to ask, what are your hopes for finding the stream further to positive phi ones?
Good question. So in the stream modeling that I've done, I've tried putting, because we don't see the progenitor, I should have said that explicitly, we don't see the progenitor. Because we don't see the progenitor, you have to make an assumption about where that final point ends up when you're doing the modeling, or you can sample over that as well. And so I've tried putting it various places like here, 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 and none of them really work because if you put it here, you tend to not be able to match the curvature of the stream on both sides. And if you put it over here, then it can reproduce the curvature here, but you predict that the stream should go way far out here. I think that's similar to what you're saying. So I've looked for the stream doing the same kind of modeling in a larger footprint, and the reason I always cut off the plot here is because I haven't been able to follow it closer into the stellar halo. So I don't know what's going on.
I want to take you right back to one of your very early slides on the orphan stream. Sorry to distract the discussion from GD1, but we'll get back to it, I'm sure. The velocities of the orphan stream. All right, now you pointed out that the velocity vectors point towards the LMC. I believe you said that, right?
I didn't say they, I did the Catherine thing. I didn't say they pointed at the LMC. I don't know which direction.
One point of velocity that points towards it.
There you go.
Not all the velocity. And most importantly,
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Sorry. There is a component of the velocity that points towards the LMC, and the whole half of the stream is moved towards the LMC as well. So it's not only component of the velocity, it's also where the that half of the stream is on the sky. Which
I think Ting will show. Ting will show more. This was meant to just.
My point is that, yeah. that if the LMC is significantly attracting these stars, those should be the directions of the acceleration vectors, and not the direction of the velocity that the stars yeah. had intrinsic Fair velocities enough. Before
You're
they
absolutely
were accelerated.
Correct. Yeah. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah, I wasn't. I don't remember which direction the LMC is actually in this coordinate system. I'm just saying, in physical distance, that's the closest point along the stream.
Well, so this is a naive question, I guess. Why is GD1 better than PAL5 for?
It's a good question. That's not naive at all. PAL5 is roughly twice the distance, so. So for GD1, this is shifted into sort of absolute magnitude, but the turnoff here is at about 18.5 or so, which is well within what Gaia can see. For PAL5, because it's roughly twice the distance, the turnoff is just at or below the region where all of the Gaia selection effects end up mattering a lot more. So the turnoff, I think, for PAL5 is closer to 20 in G-band. So if you want to get a very crisp view of the stream, the density of the stream, you want to use all the kinematic information you have. For GD1, that's easy because Gaia can see the turnoff, and for PAL5, you can't. But it's also about where it is in the sky. So.
Justin?
So, really lovely talk. I don't know if you mentioned dust. Did you mention dust?
What's that? Sorry. magnetic fields?
So, no, yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
What does magnetic field do to this?
Dust matters sort of below negative 80 here. Above that, the typical. So I don't. Do I have the plot? No, I don't think I have that plot. I have a map of SFD over this region, and you really don't see anything until like right here and below.
And as a sort of corollary to that, I mean, there is the work by Thomas DeBoer and others of the deep observations. Are all the little bumps and holes that you find perfectly correlated with what they find?
Pretty much, yeah.
Thank you.
See? Since Cher is here, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
And Cher as well.
Yeah.
So you destroy, or Cher destroys all the subhalos within 30 kpc. Of the Milky Way center, which is where the GD1 lives. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes it very difficult for it to interact with dark substrate.
I didn't realize Shay ran the simulation of the Milky Way, though.
It's true. We're still waiting for that.
Sorry, the observed Milky Way. I think James actually showed from his undergraduate that it might not be as pessimistic. Say what?
Andrew.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Andrew showed. Sorry. Thank you. From his undergraduate. What was her name? Sorry.
Yeah. I think we got a little lucky with just the first one due to that in Shay's paper, and we do a more comprehensive analysis.
The infall rates of depends on what mass you're interested in are 10 or a few tens per giga year.
Yeah.
So I'm less pessimistic than
Shay.
So this is very nice, of course. So, I'm curious what your views on the ends of the stream. Like, are they just disappearing into the noise, or is it actually truly ending?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember now which side. On this side, so on either end, it just essentially, the background becomes so high that no star has a very high probability of belonging to GD1. So it's a good question. I don't have a quantified number for you.
And you got a pretty good orbit. Presumably you've looked around the whole sky.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the answer?
I haven't found any more of GD1. So, but
there must be some odd stars that happen to have about the right distance and velocity.
True. I guess let me make my statement more precise. I've I've tried making maps on the sky like this and haven't seen a clear overdensity, but because, you know, you go to the inner halo here and you go to the disk over here, maybe this is just the wrong way of trying to do that.
Given the size of the proper motions, what is your anticipation for how DR3 might help with both here and beyond the ends?
The proper motion errors right now are pretty good already. So, I mean, say what?
It won't make a difference.
Probably not. It'll just make things worse, probably. Because, you know, in the sense that as we look even at, you know, greater and greater detail at streams like GD1, you start finding that all of our models are wrong. And so I think once we have extremely precise proper motions, it'll be even harder to model it in some sense.
Do you have hypotheses about the origin of the spur and the blob?
there would be an entire talk on that.
Okay.
We have opinions.
So I have two questions. First is on this plot. Yeah. So the BS, it seems all the stars on the spur is the blue straggler star. Is there any?
Yeah.
Yeah, only three or two, but yeah. Okay. I don't know if that's...
I mean, the density contrast between here and here is roughly 10, a factor of 10. So there's just many fewer. If you just randomly sample a couple points there.
What is the probability of that happening? That's my question.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. The other question you mentioned about the progenitor, whether it's a ultra-faint or a global cluster. I'm wondering, either in Sergey's work or in the Boss data, is there in enough member stars for metallicity measurement to show any metallicity dispersion?
Someone would have to reanalyze the Boss spectra. I don't know. It's probably possible to get metallicity information out of that, but you know, there's two stars that I think are. So there's a fourth tracer here, RGB. And I think there's two, maybe a third star in Apogee. That are giants that could be associated with GD1. They both have metallicities that are like, the two that have measured abundances have metallicities of minus 2.2 or so, but the uncertainties are 0.1 dex or something. So there's no evidence from that data that I know of, but Anna will show some follow-up spectroscopy that she's been doing.
Okay, my point is because if it's a mass of, like you said, a Buddhist one, like,
yeah.
You should see clear metallicity dispersion if it's the ultra-faint.
This is sort of a minor technical point, but obviously there's a curve to the shape you've got there. Is that because the great circle you used was not quite right, and you could straighten that out at least a bit by using a different great circle?
That's just because of where we are in the Milky Way. Like if I went to the galactic center, then we could put it closer up to zero.
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing to do.
Oh, actually, there's one other, yeah, so if you want a sense of the geometry, I do have a 3D visualization you can play with at this URL. So.
So I've seen simulations of people that can dynamically consistently model a 10 to the 6 system, particle system.
Yeah.
Has anybody thought about putting one of these into your potentials to see? Because you know the Jacobi surface flattens and you get these Lagrangian points where things leak through. Has anyone actually done a fully dynamically consistent?
You mean of a disrupting cluster?
Yeah, disrupting cluster in a halo. Because that would be
really
good.
Yeah. Many people have done that. I mean, for GD1, so from the Webb and Bovey paper, they never see density variations that look anything like this. So
yeah,
it is a puzzle.
Okay, last question.
What was the reference?
Webb. W-E-B-B.
Okay, so to finish on a light note, since you mentioned the climate again, so as a fishmonger, I would like to re-advertise my product as not trying to describe the climate, but the weak non-linearities in the weather. And in that sense, obviously, we're interested in trying to see what the fluctuation of the potential might do to the stream.
Sure.
And I believe that streams are ideal hot spots where you would be able to study how the rest of what's causing the potential to fluctuate is diffusing it away. So in
do
that
it.
Sense, maybe that's the next talk.
Okay, so let's thank again, Adrian.